Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 27th of March, these are our main stories. Thousands take to the streets in Israel over plans to overhaul the country's judicial system. Scotland elects a new leader of its main governing party. And a new school year starts in Afghanistan, but not for most of the country's girls. Also in this podcast... We are talking about the eagerly awaited puffin migration as the seabirds return home to Northern Ireland. And we start in Israel, where thousands of people have taken to the streets in protests at the government's plan to change the judicial system. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, wants to change how judges are appointed and the Supreme Court's powers would be weakened. At the moment, Mr. Netanyahu is also in the middle of a corruption trial for bribery, fraud and breach of trust. He denies all the charges. This man marching in the Israeli capital explained why he was worried about the reforms.
To be honest, it's incredible. I can't believe what's going on in Israel. It's just madness, it's complete madness. All the authorities, all the people that have the from all the jurisdictions, from the militaries, from the financial sectors, from all the sectors in Israel, saying that this reform or whatever you call it, it is completely crazy, and Israel has become a very dangerous place to be in at the moment.
Well, strike action is spreading across Israel, with shops, banks, hospitals and universities all shutting down. Razia Iqbal spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Anna Foster, and put it to her that the country was in some disarray.
I think it is. And I think yesterday evening was a real turning point. The sacking of Yoav Gallant, the defence minister, created spontaneous protests, because we've seen organised protests for 12 weeks now here in Israel. But people last night were compelled to go out onto the streets. I was here in Jerusalem and I spoke to various different people who, when they heard that news, felt that a line had been crossed. One man was telling me that he hadn't protested yet, but he felt that this was the moment that he needed to come out and, in his words, defend his country. Those demonstrations continued overnight. I was with protesters as they scrambled up through undergrowth, up to the Knesset to wave their flags, to bang pots and pans and make their voices heard. I was with them on the streets from Benjamin Netanyahu's residence as water cannon came down the road and tried to blast them with water as they paraded down there. They clearly have energy for a fight. They think that things have changed. And I think the reason they feel that things have changed today is because of that strike that you were talking about. It began this morning at Ben Gurion Airport with flights being held, not being able to depart. Now we've seen banks closed, shops closed. The fast food chain McDonald's has shut across Israel. The ports, the borders, medical staff have gone on strike. They will be providing emergency medical care only. And at this moment, the pressure is really on Benjamin Netanyahu to show some leadership, to make a decision about what he's going to do next.
What can we read into the fact that we were expecting him to speak and he has not yet?
I think that there are very difficult and very delicate conversations going on behind the scenes, conversations that have taken probably all day so far, because this has been heavily criticised by opposition politicians, by, as we heard, members of Benjamin Netanyahu's own Likud party, because Yoav Gallant, the former defence minister, was a Likud colleague. And also between the right-wing coalition partners as well, because without them, Benjamin Netanyahu does not have a functioning ruling majority. So what he has to do now is try and keep two sides happy with two very different sets of priorities. It will be very difficult for him to negotiate a solution in which both of them are happy, because the protesters, they want to see this legislation scrapped altogether. Perhaps his far-right coalition partners might agree to a pause, But for them, a scrapping would be a big capitulation. So they will be discussing where to go next, what language should be used, and how they can try and come out of it, saving some sort of face, but also really stopping this paralysis of society here in Israel, which is growing by the hour.
Anna Foster. Scotland's main governing party, the Scottish National Party, has a new leader. Humza Yousaf saw off the challenge of two other contenders. And straight after his victory, he said that it was a priority for him to rejoin the European Union. And he had this to say to the people of Scotland about the country's place within the UK.
My solemn promise and commitment to you is that I will kickstart our grassroots, our civic-led movement, and ensure our drive for independence is in fifth gear. The people of Scotland need independence now more than ever before, and we will be the generation that delivers independence for Scotland.
Well, our political correspondent Rob Watson was watching it all happen in Scotland. Rob, let's come on to those two very bold ambitions on the EU and independence from the UK in a moment. But first, tell us a few words about the man himself, Humza Yousaf.
Well, it really is an extraordinary moment for Scotland and indeed for the whole of the United Kingdom, because although he is Scotland's sixth First Minister, he's certainly the one who's come from an immigrant background. His parents and grandparents were from Pakistan. He was born here in Scotland and he is hugely proud about that. He talked about that. He's also, I think it's worth pointing out, very young, Nick. I mean, goodness, he's only 37 years old, even though he's been in government for some time. So that's him in terms of his personality. In terms of his politics, he's very much continuing the tradition of Nicola Sturgeon, the outgoing First Minister. What does one mean by that? Well, he's very much left of centre. He's very much interested in progressive issues, so things like gender recognition. And he's also very, very pro-European, so absolutely has talked about Scotland rejoining the European Union as a priority.
Those bold goals looking forward, he didn't give any kind of time frame, which was probably wise, wasn't it?
It is wise, although, of course, in the campaign, he and the other contenders had said that they hoped to have Scotland independent within 5 years. Well, of course, they say that kind of thing because it's what the party base of the Scottish National Party wants. It wants independence yesterday. But I think rather interestingly, he talked about delivering independence in this generation. And given how young he is, that would leave some time, Nick, because I think there probably is an understanding with Mr. Yousaf and indeed other in the senior ranks of the SNP that they have a long job ahead, that what they have to do is to somehow build support for independence in Scotland to a sort of overwhelming majority, the kind of majority that a government in Westminster simply couldn't ignore. And he knows, I think most politicians, most political commentators here know, that Scotland is not at that point yet. It is very much a country split along the lines of 50, just under 50% wanting independence, but more than 50% not.
Yeah, absolutely. He also knows that being outside the UK and still outside the European Union would be a very cold place indeed as well, wouldn't it?
Yes, and in many ways it rather complicates the task of independence for Scotland. I mean, the idea originally when they have the referendum in 2014, Nick, was that it would all be fairly straightforward because both Scotland would be inside the EU, so would the rest of the UK. They would all be inside the single market and the customs union, and we all know how chaotic it's been for Britain to leave the single market and the customs union. So in many ways, the sort of the technical economic picture is even more difficult than it was in 2014. And I think, again, that is why I think he and others in the SNP think that they have this a kind of a long haul towards independence, that sort of slowly inch by inch, as he would put it, on the doorstep, trying to persuade people that that Scotland could make it as an independent country.
That was Rob Watson. Another school year has started in Afghanistan, but teenage girls have been again forced to stay at home. The Taliban government has barred girls and women from secondary schools and universities in Afghanistan, the only government in the world to do so. This report from the BBC's South Asia correspondent, Yogita Limai.
As a new school year began, Afghan women were out on the streets again. Education is our right. It's our red line. Don't politicize it. They chanted as they marched in Kabul, protesting against the Taliban's bar on secondary school education for girls. Crucial years are being wasted for tens of thousands, like 15-year-old Tamanna. She isn't able to hold back tears.
When I see the boys go to school and do whatever they want, I feel hurt. It's hard to hope that our schools will be reopened.
It's evident on Tamanna's face that her grief is still raw.
When I see my brother going to school, I feel sad and broken. Earlier, my brother used to say, "I won't go to school without you." I would hug him and say, "You go, I will join you later," because I thought the Taliban might change their minds.
Almost every time we've spoken to teenage girls in Afghanistan about school, they've broken down within minutes of the conversation. Some are trying to find ways around the ban. Barasto is in her 20s. She runs a network of secret schools, trying to help as many girls as possible continue their studies hidden away from the Taliban.
You talk to so many of these students who aren't allowed to go to school. Can you explain for us what that's like day to day? What is their life like?
It is devastating, it's frightening, it's heartbroken, and it is the worst of all is not having any hope and being helpless, because nobody right now in the world speak about helping us. They just condemn, and that's all they think that they have to do.
Aren't you scared that you might get caught?
Oh, absolutely. I'm scared, but we still have to do that because we do not have any other way. The thing that billions of girls in all around the world are doing very freely as they are wishing to do, girls in Afghanistan have to do that secretly with all the fear in the world inside their heart.
Threats from the Taliban have forced women's rights activist Leila Basim to close the library she had opened for women. Leila's library was one of the few places where women could freely meet, because following the secondary school ban, a series of blows have been inflicted on women's freedoms. Now also barred from universities and from public places like parks, gyms and swimming pools. I spoke to Leila over the phone.
The Taliban used to call me saying, "How dare you establish a library and do such activities?" Once, they visited us and said this is not a place for women. Women must stay at home.
The Taliban say the closure of schools and universities is temporary until a suitable environment can be created. The women and girls we spoke to said they did not believe them, but had no option but to hope.
That was Yogita Limai. A rescue ship funded by the British street artist Banksy has been seized in Italy. That's after the Coast Guard said that the crew had disobeyed its orders. The ship was told to return to Sicily after a rescue operation, but instead went to help three more migrant boats. Stephanie Prentice reports.
It's the rescue boat known for its famous financial backer, as well as its top speeds, described by the crew as being able to outrun human traffickers. Named after a French feminist anarchist, Louise Michel has reportedly saved hundreds of migrants at sea over the past 3 years. But the white and pink vessel provided by the British street artist Banksy has now been impounded with no timeline for its release.
As far as we are aware, there are at least 15 distress cases as we speak that we could be helping, and we are not because we're not allowed to leave the port.
In a series of tweets, its crew described a clash at sea with the Italian Coast Guard over the weekend. They say they were told to leave an area at sea but ignored it after coming across 34 people in the water at night. A mother holding an unconscious baby was among those they brought on board. In response, the Coast Guard said they were complicating delicate rescue work and said that charity boats have to stick to a code of conduct. UN data suggests that 10 times more people are attempting to cross into Lampedusa this year compared to last year, and at least 29 migrants have died in recent days. But Tunisia is a country facing instability on many fronts, and with better weather conditions on the horizon, the number of people trying to reach Italy is sure to increase, and so are clashes between the Coast Guard and rescuers.
That was Stephanie Prentice. Coming up, we're in Myanmar. where the military leader has been talking tough in a rare public speech. But first, the firing of an intercontinental ballistic missile by North Korea in the past few weeks has reminded the world of the growing threat posed by the country's weapons program. So how is a country that struggles to feed its own people funding these growing military activities? Well, starting on Monday, the 27th of March, season two of the Lazarus Heist podcast from the BBC World Service investigates the latest exploits of cyber hackers claimed to be linked to the North Korean state, an allegation Pyongyang denies. Joining me now are the hosts of the Lazarus Heist, Jeff White and Jean Lee. Jean, if I can start with you, you opened the first US news bureau in Pyongyang and you still watch the country very closely. Can you tell us about North Korea's increase in weapons testing and why they're doing it now?
The North Koreans right now are trying to portray this as a defensive measure. They say they're taking this to protect the country from U.S. aggression. But really, it's about Kim Jong-un. He's the leader of North Korea. And it's about the Kim family hold on power. Kim Jong-un, he's a young man. He's built his leadership and his legacy around nuclear weapons. And at home, he has told his people that North Korea faces an existential crisis, that they need him, his family's leadership, and nuclear weapons to survive. And I would say he's also using weapons as a way to gain international stature. So he does want to force the world to accept North Korea as a nuclear power. And he wants to use those weapons to negotiate economic concessions. You know, this isn't a new strategy. These nuclear ambitions go back some 30 years to his father and his grandfather. We've seen 30 years of attempted negotiations and sanctions to try to stop North Korea from building these weapons, sanctions designed to stop the flow of money into the program. And, you know, go back to season one if you're interested in hearing some of the crazy stories about their past history of illicit money making. And we've got more stories to share in season two about how they're making that money today.
Well, let me stop you there, Jean, because I'm going to bring in Jeff now, your colleague on the podcast. Jeff, so how exactly are they going about doing this financially?
Well, as Jean's alluded to, you know, North Korea has this campaign of missile launches and nuclear tests that all has to be paid for somehow. As a result of those tests and launches, North Korea has been placed under these sanctions, very heavy sanctions. It's kind of hard to figure out how North Korea can sort of function as a country. You're buying and selling things, the basic things countries do, are largely sealed off for North Korea. And so the accusation is that North Korea has used its government hackers, computer hackers, to break into banks and financial institutions around the world and steal the money. And in terms of amounts, we're looking at the latest estimate on the amount of cryptocurrency, things like Bitcoin and so on, stolen by North Korea's government hackers is something in the region of $2.1 billion.
So are they particularly adept at doing this, or are other people around the world doing some similar things? What have the North Koreans tapped into?
Well, it's worth pointing out, when we say North Korean hackers, the only way you get a computer or an internet connection in North Korea is if the government grants that to you. So it's not like the UK where you might have bedroom hackers, you know, the classic kids in hoodies hacking. That just couldn't exist in North Korea. The government has to sanction any computer use. And so when we're talking about North Korea's computer hackers, we're talking about government hackers, is the accusation. Shouldn't come as a surprise. North Korea has hackers. Most countries do, including the UK. We have government hackers who hack on behalf of the government. The difference in the North Korean case is that they are going after cash, is the accusation. In terms of how they work, very classic tactics. It's sending out phishing messages, phishing emails, you know, messaging people on LinkedIn, for example, and trying to trick them into downloading computer viruses that can then be used to get access to their computers. But of course, once you're inside somebody's computers, if the computer's in a bank, you can potentially then steal the bank's millions of dollars.
And tell us, the Lazarus Group, why have they been nicknamed that?
They wouldn't themselves call themselves the Lazarus Group. They are almost certainly a unit within the North Korean military and probably have military ranks and unit assignments and so on. The Lazarus name came about because a bunch of security researchers called them that, largely because if they break into your computer networks, you know, you get your techies on top of it and you try and kill them off. But just like the Christian Saint Lazarus, the North Korean hackers have a habit of coming back from the dead and reinfecting your systems.
Listen, thank you very much, Jeff White and Jean Lee. I will be listening avidly to that. Thanks for your time. Now to a vast parade ground in Myanmar.
No! No!
It was a textbook show of military strength, with jets flying overhead, saluting troops, tanks and missile launchers. The head of Myanmar's military junta was at the centre of it all, marking Armed Forces Day. General Min Aung Hlaing, who took power in a coup 18 months ago, promised to deal decisively with what he called acts of terror from the armed groups challenging his rule. Our correspondent Jonathan Head was there watching in the capital, Naypyidaw.
There were no signs of a softening of his line. It was very much, a tough approach to his opponents, accusing all of those who've taken up arms against the military government as being terrorists, even accusing countries that have criticised his human rights record, that means, you know, Europe, Britain, the United States, Canada and the rest, of being terror-supporting countries, and saying, basically, we are on track eventually, and we don't know when this is going to happen, to return to a form of democracy that we like. And that means a form of democracy where there is no Aung San Suu Kyi and there is no party capable of challenging the military's now 60-year-long dominance or monopoly on power.
At the moment, that dominance on power is being held in place by a lot of Chinese and Russian weaponry. Until that flow of weapons stops, it's going to be quite easy for the generals to keep in power?
Not easy. I think the problem they have at the moment is they are in power here in Naypyidaw. This is almost a fortified capital. It's a very hard place to describe. It was built specifically by the military to make themselves feel safer 20 years ago. And they have their own special exclusive zone that no one can go into. And yet there are large parts of the country where the communities reject the authority of the military and are willing to fight them. These are very desperate battles now where increasingly the army is going in force. It's using a lot more air power. That's where these Russian and Chinese planes and helicopters that we saw parading, flying over today, we know they've been used extensively in airstrikes on rebellious communities, and the civilian cost is very, very high. And I think the military is hoping that if they can keep this up, they will eventually grind the opposition down, that people with no other support, there's no countries backing the opposition, will eventually have to give up.
And what indication is there that the insurgency is finding it very difficult to carry on?
It's always difficult because they've got very few weapons and they are getting intercepted a lot. A lot of insurgents, very young, untrained volunteers are being killed, often in the most unspeakably brutal way. The soldiers are fond of dismembering their bodies and sort of displaying them in some gross kind of butchery. There's a lot of shock tactics being used. I will say atrocities are not wholly on one side, but certainly the military is responsible for some dreadful, dreadful incidents. I mean, interestingly, here in Naypyidaw, which is notionally very secure, the hills that form the backdrop to that giant parade ground divide it from an area about 50 kilometres away where there is constant fighting and where insurgents there claim they killed 90 soldiers just in the last few days and have been showing pictures of huge weapons hauls they've got. So in that area, which borders Thailand, the insurgents have been very successful. But in other areas, it really is a desperate fight. They've got very few weapons. They're very determined. But you can only go so far when you're cut off from any external support from outside.
That was Jonathan Head. Social anxiety is a very common disorder that can cause an overwhelming fear of social situations. To help calm the senses, people often try meditating or sniffing pleasant smells like lavender. But now researchers in Sweden are suggesting that body odour could help alleviate symptoms. The newsroom's Phoebe Hobson has more.
Body odour is normally something you'd want to avoid smelling, but according to Swedish researchers, a whiff may have a calming effect. Their hunch is armpit sweat may activate brain pathways linked to emotions that could be used in therapy for social anxiety. Volunteers were asked to donate armpit sweat from when they were watching either a scary movie or a happy one. 48 women with social anxiety agreed to sniff these samples, alongside receiving a more conventional therapy called mindfulness, where people are encouraged to focus on the here and now rather than replaying negative thoughts. Some of the women were given genuine body odour to sniff, while others, the control group, were given clean air instead. Those who were exposed to sweat, even if produced when watching a scary movie, appeared to do better with the therapy. Before you ditch your deodorant, more tests need to be carried out, but scientists say the findings are promising.
That was Phoebe Hobson. Now, as you may have noticed here on the Global News Pod, occasionally we like to end the programme with a bit of a fluffy story. So we're going to talk about puffins now. With their bright orange feet, distinctive parrot-like bills and puffy white cheeks, they're sometimes called the clowns of the sea or sea parrots. They spend winters at sea but return at the same time each year to the UK to nest in their burrows in the ground. They are extremely loyal. They mate with the same bird and produce one chick known as a puffling. Today or tomorrow, the puffins will arrive back on a tiny island off the coast of Northern Ireland called Rathlin Island. Here they are, returning there a couple of years ago. Happy return from the puffins there. Rebecca Tanner has the great title of Experience Manager at Britain's Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And she worked in Northern Ireland last year. Justin Webb asked her whether we know why puffins are so precise with their timings and return on the 27th or 28th of March each year.
I don't think we know how they're doing it so precisely, that's for sure. The reason they're coming back to land at this time of year is it's the start of their breeding season. But they are very, very regular with it. And yeah, I don't think anyone really knows exactly how they do it.
It is. I mean, it's one of the extraordinary things about them, quite apart from their ability to travel huge areas and to seem to know where they're going, that makes them so fascinating. I suppose all seabirds are, but there's something particularly fascinating, isn't there, about puffins?
They're very, very charismatic. They've obviously got that very colourful appearance, very recognisable. So people do get very excited to see them, yeah.
And where do they go when they've been away? So we're talking about them all coming back and really huge numbers on Rathlin Island and other parts of the UK as well, certainly parts of Scotland. Where have they all been in the same place or not?
We think not. So they disperse over a really large area. They go out into the middle of the Atlantic, they go into the North Sea, and they can go as far as south as about the Bay of Biscay. So they really do like sort of scatter around and then, yeah, what's amazing is they all come back to the same place.
And all gather together. And it's kind of an amazing sight, isn't it, of huge numbers of birds together. But does that tell, in a sense, the wrong story? So are they threatened? Are they reduced in numbers? Is life getting more difficult for them?
Yeah, so puffins, as well as lots of our seabirds that we get in the UK, are threatened. So puffins in particular, numbers are declining. There's a couple of reasons for that. So their food source, sand eels, are becoming more scarce. That might be because of climate change or overfishing. There's other risks to them as well. So things like lights in the evenings, that when the pufflings are fledging, they can be attracted to the wrong thing and they go into land. Mm-hmm. Also, at the moment, bird flu is a big problem for lots of our seabirds. So,
I was going to ask you about that. What's the impact of bird flu been?
It's really, really difficult to say because obviously these birds nest in huge numbers. So on Rathlin, there was about 150,000 guillemots, and those are the birds that we're seeing dying off quite a lot across the whole of the UK. And yeah, it can be quite hard to say. And I think this year will really show just what the impact's been, because we know for a fact that even though they left the cliffs and they weren't in such close proximity to each other, once they like head out into the water, there have been reports of them washing up and being affected with bird flu. So we don't really know what the impact's going to be.
That was Rebecca Tanner from the RSPB. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop, and the producer was Phoebe Hobson and Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
A series of increasingly sophisticated cybercrimes being carefully orchestrated around the world.
The attraction to target ATMs is fairly obvious. I mean, they're full of cash.
It was just like abracadabra. Put these cards, put any PIN number, and you get money.
Jackpot.
US investigators say the heists are being carried out by the Lazarus Group, a criminal hacking gang who are said to be working under the orders of the North Korean state.
Tens of millions of dollars for the North Koreans.
These actors are not as anonymous as they think they are.
The group's goal? To steal money to help fund the country's growing ballistic missile and nuclear program.
But despite evidence suggesting otherwise, North Korea denies any involvement.
In season two of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service, we're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
And piles of stolen cash.
Over $2 billion. We're at $2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.